Good evening, everybody. Hello to those of you at home. So this is our last meeting on this sutra. And from the beginning, I had mentioned that we weren't going to be covering every chapter. And when we last met, we spent really most of the time on the article by Alan Sponberg. So I want to just touch on a few points from a number of the chapters, a couple of chapters from last meeting that we didn't really talk about, and then a couple of chapters that were part of tonight. I apologize to all the Buddhas and ancestors for not doing a thorough job of this sutra. So there's a chapter on Devadatta, who, along with all of these other disciples of the Buddha, has received the prediction for becoming a Buddha in some future eon. And so, again, to look at the significance of why that person. So most of you know that Devadatta was related to the Buddha and was evidently quite a powerful person, a powerful practitioner, a fairly developed practitioner in the Buddhist Sangha. But he became a thorn, basically, in the Sangha. It was antagonistic towards the Buddha. At one point came to the Buddha and said, it's really time for you to step down and let somebody else step in and lead the community. The Buddha declined that invitation. Devadatta left and took a portion of the Sangha with him, or a portion of the Sangha went with him, because he was a powerful person and teacher. And so the Buddha then sent a couple of his disciples to talk to that portion of the Sangha and I think retrieve many of them. I recently came across, I remembered reading a Jataka tale, which are the tales of all of the Buddha's previous lives, or many of them, in which he was taking different forms, different human beings, different creatures, and as he was evolving along his path to the point where he became Shakyamuni. And there's a story of he and Devadatta, in the story, there's just two people who were both merchants who were had worked together, and they went to some distant city to do some sales, and they agreed that they would split up the city so that they wouldn't overlap and compete with each other. And Devadatta went to a house to see if they had anything they wanted to sell. And there was a very poor woman, widow, and her daughter. And they had nothing to sell because they were so poor. But the daughter remembered that her father had left a bowl that he had had. And the mother said, that old thing is not worth a penny. It's all, dirty. But they brought it out anyway to this merchant, who scratched the bottom and realized it was pure gold. And so he realized they didn't know what it was, and he could make a lot of money. And so he was disdainful of it and said, this isn't worth anything. And, why are you even bothering me about this? And so then he left, and he had a plan that he was going to come back and offer to take it off their hands, for nothing, and make a large profit. But in that time, in between that time, the other merchant, who was the Buddha in an earlier life, went and was offered the bowl and realized that it was very valuable and told them so. And he couldn't afford to pay all the money that it was worth, but he paid everything that he had. And David Atta found out and was very upset. And Buddha said, in sort of summarizing the story, that that was the beginning of the bad seed between them, that then went on through successive lifetimes. And so at the time when he became Shakyamuni, there was this very strong sort of old karmic enmity that Devadatta had. So all of that is significant for understanding why in this chapter does the Buddha not only predict that he will become a Buddha, but said that he said, the fact that I have attained impartial and impartial, that is, unbiased and correct enlightenment and can save living beings on a broad scale is all due to Devadatta, who was a good friend. And so he's pointing to how he had been a positive influence in past lives, and then he goes on to make the prediction. And so this, again, is just in the spirit of all of these, not only the those who had thought that they had already attained enlightenment, the early disciples, all of these people, and now sort of the most unlikely of all people to receive this prediction, the Buddha offers that. There's also then the story of the dragon girl, who I alluded to, we didn't really go into it, who demonstrates, Manjushri says, you know, because it took the Buddha so long to become enlightened, is there anybody who has become enlightened quickly? And so this dragon, daughter of the dragon king, appears, who's just 8 years old, and basically in an instant becomes enlightened. And I was reading a commentary on that that spoke about how she represented basically all of the sort of traditional ways in which women were considered not able, different roles that they were of leadership or authority that they were considered not able to have, and that becoming a Buddha was the most, you know, supreme of all of those. So by her doing this, she's demonstrating that not only that it's possible to become enlightened very you know, in this lifetime, but also that she basically not transcended, but basically dissolved all of those, demonstrated that she dissolved all of those supposed barriers. And that sense of being able to come to enlightenment more quickly, or rather not requiring this sort of infinitely long cycle of lives and deaths and this long, long, long bodhisattva path, you know, it's kind of interesting within the bodhisattva teaching, because in the Buddha's time, you know, there were lots of his disciples that were, he was acknowledging, who had attained enlightenment. And yet within the bodhisattva sort of teaching, you know, it takes all of these successive lifetimes. And yet within the Zen tradition, right, that was not something that had a lot of resonance, it seems, for the for those early Chinese Buddhist practitioners who were interested in, you know, coming to realization in this lifetime. There are also schools of Tibetan Buddhism that teach that it is possible to come to realization in this lifetime. And so this, we might call it a kind of tension or a question, you know, that was very active, perhaps in every generation, you know, because in every generation, we would imagine that there would be people who would be very curious about whether it was possible to come to enlightenment now, right? Rather than, you know, at some subsequent lifetime. So that chapter is interesting in that way. In the next chapter, I just want to, and I'm just going to go through some things and then we can have some questions and comments. In the next chapter, the Buddha makes a number of predictions, and I came across something in this chapter, this text on Nagarjuna, that was interesting in light of this sutra and all of these predictions. So this is Nagarjuna's guide to the Bodhisattva path, and in which Nagarjuna says, he's talking about dharmas as not being born or destroyed, as for not produced and not destroyed, nor unproduced nor undestroyed. One asserts, one denies assertions of both and neither. This is a traditional sort of mode of analysis, particularly with Nagarjuna, to basically use a philosophical tool to show that all of the different possibilities that essentially end up reifying or solidifying one perspective or another are untenable, as a way to conceptually instill faith in, or doubt rather, in all of those different sort of arguing point possibilities. And so he's sort of in that kind of a process here of that kind of discussion. And then he says, no matter which existent dharma one encounters, in other words, no matter which dharma we encounter that appears and that we might think has its own autonomous independent existence, one persists therein in the contemplation, in other words, we examine it through our meditation, remaining unmoving. This is the unproduced dharma's patience. In other words, that practice of meeting dharma, a dharma phenomena, in meditation, in a deep state of meditation, and remaining unmoving, in other words, not creating any ideas, not proliferating, he describes as the unproduced dharma's patience, the patience in which no dharma is being created. He says, this is based on the severance of all mental discriminations. The mind is not distinguishing. And then he says, once one gains this patience, one immediately receives the prediction, you will definitely become a Buddha. It is then that one achieves irreversibility. So it's very interesting how he takes, and clearly he would know about this sutra, about predictions that have been made. And so here he's again shifting it. You know, last couple times ago, I read some passages from Hakuin, and I think was it also Bodhidharma, that were sort of shifting a way of looking at it into basically the study of the self, the nature of mind. In other words, really bringing it inwardly, turning the light around, rather than it being something that happens out here. And so here, Nagarjuna is doing something very similar in terms of this prediction, that at the moment one gains this unproduced dharma's patience, is able to see directly into the nature of things without mental discrimination, in that moment, you have received the prediction of becoming a Buddha. It is then that you achieve irreversibility. In other words, there's no going back. Those bodhisattvas already dwelling at the stage of immovability have gained irreversible wisdom, cognizing all dharma's reality. It is at this point that they are designated as irreversible. And so, I just wanted to share that. A different light on receiving a prediction. The prediction basically comes from within. So let me just pause there actually and see if there are any questions or comments so far. Who's got the mic?
So that paragraph you just talking about is in the Burton Watson's is talking about Bodhisattva Mahasattva, the practice. And And that paragraph that, you know, I just cannot stop just looking back.
Which paragraph are you looking
at? The paragraph that the Buddha said, you know, the practice of the Bodhisattva, the Mahasattva, is to take this stand of perseverance.
Perseverance.
And translate to the patience. Mm-hmm. But I look at the Chinese version, mm-hmm. so that it's stand, abide in the state of enduring humiliation.
Humiliation.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is really point to my heart, because it's really something that you need to take practice.
Humiliation or humility?
Humiliation. So in Chinese it said, 助人努力, then it's enduring. Mm-hmm. Nu is insulting, humiliation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then so then the following that gradually you perceive, then I'm reading this translation of mm-hmm. this. Mm-hmm. It say, moreover, he has no laws by which to act, but sees all things in their reality, long perceive along the undivided ways. So that means you take this practice to enduring mm-hmm. the humiliation, but then there's gradually perceive into the practice of there's no humiliation. Mm-hmm. There's no state of humiliation that you have to take on. Mm-hmm. And so there's no I, no subject and object. So this is really something, mm-hmm. something that it to me is like we say you take a precept, you take the vow, the vow, and you do the meditation, mm-hmm. and then you gain the wisdom. Mm-hmm. So is that like this, that you gradually in that meditation, and you really enter the state of, you know, non-dividing, mm-hmm. the, you know, equanimity. So can you say something about this?
Yeah, so there are a lot of, it shows up a lot in the teachings, in the early teachings. There are early sutras that speak about this, and also in particularly in Mahayana, that when we are experiencing something that is very difficult, that's coming from another, that traditionally that's understood as a result of past actions that we have committed that are now bearing fruit in something that is being directed towards us. And we've talked a lot about this in the past, and the traditional way of understanding the sometimes problematic aspect of that in terms of, you know, not acknowledging that sometimes what's happening on the outside is just wrong and unjust. But in terms of the practice that there's real emphasis on in that moment, from the point of view that this is the result of my past actions, that I now have the opportunity, because it's bearing fruit, to turn that karma if I don't respond with anger, right? So if I'm on the receiving end of some anger, that if I don't respond out of the three poisons, out of the kleshas, then I can turn that karma and begin to free myself. And so there's a practice of that, right, of patience, of enduring, of forbearing. But ultimately, it is to move towards what Nagarjuna was saying, was this immovability, where we're able to be so non-discriminatory, so dispassionate, which means unreactive, basically, that the mind is stable and is able to see into the emotion, into what's happening, particularly the emotion, whatever might be arising, that we would normally react to, but we don't. And so then we're able to see it in its true nature and realize that it's empty, and then be liberated from that. And so that comes up a lot in the teachings. And okay. Yusen, are you reviewing something there?
I can try.
Can you?
Okay, it's a question from Miyoho. My question is, the dragon child, in a sense, upends the social order. If they were verbalized, though it wasn't that from the patriarchal point of view, this created great disharmony. Similarly, the way women's lib could create a backlash, and even now, Roe versus Wade, that broken, unvoiced 13th precept.
I think we are led to understand that at the time, these kinds of passages would have been considered somewhat revolutionary, right? We talked a little bit about, when we talked last week, about, you know, the Mahayana trying to present its view, which was much more expansive and inclusive, at the same time that it was trying to actually gain credence at the time within culture, society, practitioners, and sort of trying to find that balance. So, yeah. Okay, so let's go on and look briefly at the peaceful practices. And I think I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that because it's kind of self-explanatory. So here the Buddha, the question is, how should bodhisattvas go about preaching this sutra? And again, I would read that, this preaching this sutra, as living it, realizing it, practicing, expounding it, not just teaching, but bringing it to life within a life, bringing it to life in what we do. So it's not just about, it's not just a sort of a missionary project. And so then the Buddha goes on to say that that they should abide by four rules. And then he talks about, first, abide by the practices and associations proper for bodhisattvas. And so what does he mean by this? To stand on perseverance, to cultivate great patience, the patience paramita, to be gentle and compliant, never violent, never alarmed in the mind. I would read that as being agitated or upended. With regard to phenomena, to take no action. Remember again what Nagarjuna talked about in terms of being immovable, meeting without the mind discriminating, but observe the true entity of phenomena without acting or making any distinction. So to see through the real nature of things. And then he goes on through a long list of associations one should not have, which is very interesting because a lot of these are the people that you would be, you know, trying to serve and alleviate the suffering of, and that are actually, you know, part of this sutra in lots of other sections where they are being acknowledged and taught. And so the way I read that, be careful of associations, is it's kind of the more sort of renunciation element of Mahayana Buddhism that shows up. You know, there's Vimalakirti on the one hand, who was like going into brothels and casinos and like all the places that were considered inappropriate for a practitioner. And that, within the Buddha's time, with renunciant monastic, celibate monastics, there were lots of rules about where they were not to go and people they were not to associate with, and rules and regulations regarding proximity and so on. And that within that more universal, you know, inclusiveness of the Mahayana, there still are many teachings about renunciation. You know, there are teachings about don't have any friends, leave your family, you know, that's just going to cause you trouble. You know, go off into the mountain. And which is a kind of an interesting thing, I find, within the Mahayana teaching about alleviating suffering and being in service to all beings. And to realize the unity between samsara and nirvana at the same time that samsara in many teachings is really being presented as, you know, it's going to be an obstacle to your practice. Now, you could look at that as just, you know, there are times where we need to, you know, go to Sishin, go to the mountain, you know, pull away from those worldly concerns. But this section is, I think, is how I read that. And then he goes on to talk about other practices. If there are persons who come with good hearts to the place of the Bodhisattva in order to hear the Buddha way, then the Bodhisattva with a fearless heart, but without harboring expectations, should preach the law for them. Without expectations, without grasping, without attachment, without trying to control. He says that if somebody asks difficult questions, that one should try to respond from the point of view of the great vehicle, the one Dharma that the Buddha is expounding in this sutra, not from a sort of lesser teaching or understanding. That Bodhisattva should not harbor a mind marked by jealousy or deceit, should not be contemptuous or revile those who study the Buddha way, or to look for their shortcomings. There's a passage where he's basically talking about having right speech, not to speak in demeaning ways or critical ways, that they should cultivate a mind of great compassion. And towards those who are not Bodhisattvas, they should also cultivate a mind of great compassion. He says, though the thus come one, as an expedient means, preaches the Dharma in accordance with what is appropriate, there are those who do not listen, do not know, do not realize, do not inquire, do not believe, do not understand. And although those persons do not inquire, don't believe, and don't understand the sutra, when I have attained Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, wherever I may happen to be, I will employ my transcendental powers and their power of wisdom to draw them to me and cause them to turn towards the Dharma. So, you can understand that as not giving up on anyone. Okay, so I think that's all I wanted to say about that chapter. And anybody wanted to present anything or ask anything? Mm-hmm. Joseph?
Thanks. So I wanted to clarify something and also to point out another kind of tension I see. The clarification is around the idea of not having any expectations. Should we be viewing that as like expectation of generating a merit or expectation of like enlightening other beings?
I think you could apply it to anything.
Just no expectation.
I mean, he is not really qualified, but I mean, expectations in general, right, are something that we grasp onto and fix in our minds as something that should be, that we want. And whether that's directed towards ourselves or whether it's directed towards another, it's grasping, right? And that then prevents us from actually practicing what is actually in front of us, because we're trying to get to what should be. And so, I mean, in that passage, because he says it in a couple of different ways, you know, I think it it could be read, and I would think misread, as, you know, don't expect too much.
That's why I read it initially.
Yeah. But I don't see any value in that, right?
Yeah.
In terms of a teaching or something that we want to reflect on, right? That doesn't really help us. And so, and it's really also in a way not consistent with the sutra itself. So I would see it more in terms of, you know, teaching with an open hand. You know, that the Buddha in his own time, you know, people like today brought themselves, you know, as students inquiring, wanting to, asking, you know, to enter, and then the Buddha offered. And then it's really up to the student, you know, to take it from there.
So that makes sense. And then I wanted to go back to the tension that you mentioned about the renunciative aspect of the Mahayana. In particular, the way that I understood the Bodhisattva vow to, right, save all sentient beings, you would think that that involves going out as Vimalakirti did into the world and preaching for them. But here it says not to visit them. And there's also other parts in the sutra where it's like, anyone who recites or expounds out the sutra will generate a lot of merit. If the Bodhisattva is not supposed to seek out these, essentially, I think, non-Bodhisattvas, since the list kind of enumerates like almost every, well, I'm thinking out loud, I'm sorry. I guess it's, there's a part where it says, like, don't try to talk to the monastics and the lay people who follow the lesser vehicles, I get, or the Theravada. I guess in this context, it could be about, like, not, like, creating sectarian strife or whatever. But anyway, if there are all these sentient beings that the Bodhisattvas are not supposed to associate with, then how will they save them?
Good question. I think there's a problem there. That's why I said the way I would read that is to, you know, sort of within that general, you know, the Buddha said that the Sangha is a community of good friends, right? Noble friends, because we are brought together by the Dharma. We're trying to do something. We're trying to do it together. So we're mutually supportive and so on. We support in something that is difficult to do. And so, as I said, there are lots of teachings that talk about how, you know, our best efforts will at times get entangled in the affairs of other people, of life, of society, of circumstances, so on. And so there are lots of sort of cautions around that. But, you know, we could also look at this as just as an historical text that was, scholars, you know, say was likely composed over time. And so if there are inconsistencies in it, you know, are they attributed to that? So because we don't know, you know, the way I read these sutras is I look for anything like that that seems inconsistent or just at face value, just kind of doesn't make sense. You know, if I can find a way of understanding it or sort of interpreting it that is helpful, then that's helpful. You know, otherwise, there's something I'm just not understanding, and that's always a possibility, or I just let it be. Okay. You know, renunciation is a part of, I mean, it's spoken about, you know, very explicitly in the early tradition, particularly within the monastic ordained tradition, but it's very much a part of, I mean, in the sense of renunciation, meaning to give up something that we would rather not give up, right? That we have a desire for. Then practice always requires some degree of renunciation. Within a monastic context, that refers to things that we're not in control of. You know, that we, when we enter into practicing together, there are many things that as individuals we don't have control over, right? Because we enter into a way of training in which there is a, something that we are agreeing to enter into and use. And so we're not going to decide. I'm not going to decide when I'm going to get up and who I'm going to sit next to and what I'm going to have for breakfast and what my work schedule is and so on. And so those renunciations. The other thing I wanted to mention in terms of merit, just because you brought that up, that which is a very, very important part of, you know, Buddhism, generally refers to acts that are promoting or strengthening or bringing forth the Dharma. So you could look at merit as a result of a positive action, but it's generally not spoken of just in terms of positive good karma. It's always referred to things that are done that specifically help to strengthen practice, to make it possible for people to practice, to translate sutras, to provide for people to be ordained, to build monasteries, also to engage in practices of bodhisattva practices, so releasing animals or creatures that might otherwise be confined or killed is a merit-producing act. And so merit is generally pointing to those kinds of actions, not just, you know, generally good actions.
Back to Joseph's question about if there, these are all sentient beings, you're not supposed to associate with them. Is it associate with them or associate with where the topsy-turviness that they're living in? So you can associate with them, but don't associate with them.
It's like don't get entangled in there.
Because he's saying keep that mind of the Buddha at all times when you're associating.
Yeah, I like that.
I like that. Otherwise we're stuck.
That works. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a nice way of looking at it where both aspects are there. You know, there's the bodhisattva element, but there's also how to be, you know, in the presence of a person, right? Because when we enter into their field, we enter into their field, you know, their mind, their body, their karma. You know, think about relationships that we have with each other, particularly, you know, close, intimate relationships, long relationships, family, you know, that are sort of our karmic streams get very intermixed, right? And that that's part of what makes it a relationship. And that we, you know, when we're choosing a relationship, to be in relationship with somebody on an ongoing basis, part of what we're choosing is to enter into their karma, right? Their karmic field, and for them to enter into ours, right? And so how do we do that in a way that's beneficial for both, for everyone? So that's a nice way of looking at that.
And also,
Mike?
Here.
You're looking at the Chinese?
Yeah, here from the, I think it's talking about the beginning of the practice for peoples, you know, they haven't have the body mind.
Does it give some indication of that?
Yes, early? And so first you have to close to the place that bodhisattva is hang around, and so something like, you know, you go to the teachers, you know, close to the teachers, and there's one example here is that in one of the sutra, the Manjushri, he let his students and visited 53, you know, mm-hmm. people with, you know, good knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right. So this is just, you know, a way to, yeah. to like, to bring us to the path.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that would also really make sense, too, because it's, you know, I mean, in a way, it's like in formal training where we enter in and we don't have many extra responsibilities. Things are made a little bit more simple, right? So that, because there's enough to deal with in the beginning, just within ourselves. And then that begins to be expanded upon. Yeah. Okay. So this next chapter on never disparaging, 20 is what I wanted to go to next. And so again, the sutra invokes this time. after the correct law, I'm on in the Watson edition on 266 at the bottom. After the correct law, the true Dharma has passed away in the period of the counterfeit law. Monks of overbearing arrogance exercise great authority and power. At this time, there was a Bodhisattva monk named Never Disparaging. And so he goes on to talk about how this was a time when the fourfold Sangha, monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen, would bow in obeisance. That Never Disparaging Bodhisattva would bow in obeisance to all of them, even though they were really, you know, not very good practitioners. And would praise them, saying, I have profound reverence for you. I would never dare treat you with disparagement or arrogance. Why? Because you are all practicing the Bodhisattva way and are certain to attain Buddhahood. And it says, this Bodhisattva didn't devote his time to reading or reciting scriptures, but simply went about bowing to people. And that among those four kinds of believers, there were those who gave way to anger, their minds lacking in purity, they spoke ill of him, cursed him, saying, this ignorant monk, where does he come from? Presuming to declare that he does not disparage us and bestowing a prediction on us that we will attain Buddhahood. We have no use for such vain and irresponsible predictions. And as years passed, he just continued with this practice, enduring, patiently enduring, forbearing all of these curses and abuses. He did not give way to anger, but each time said, you are certain to attain Buddhahood. And even if they threw sticks and tiles at him, he would just run just out of distance and then would call out, I'll never disparage you. But then at a certain point, as he was approaching death, he heard up in the sky a million verses of the Lotus Sutra and was able to accept and hold them all. In other words, to come to complete enlightenment and gain the purity and vision of the faculties, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. His lifespan was increased. And at that time, all of those four kinds of believers who had been disparaging him all this time suddenly realized that he gained great transcendental powers. They all took faith in him and willingly became his followers. And then the Buddha says, at that time, this fourfold Sangha, because anger arose in their minds and they treated me with disparagement and contempt, were for 200 million kalpas never able to encounter a Buddha, to hear the Lord, or see the community of monks. He says, the four kinds of believers who at that time constantly disparaged as Bodhisattva could be unknown to you. Do you think they could be unknown to you? In fact, they are in this assembly right now. And then he goes on to name the groups in which they are here right now. He says, you should understand this sutra richly benefits Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, for it can cause them to attain Anuttaram Samyak Sambodhi. So to turn against, to be disparaging, to draw blood, to throw something, was considered an extremely serious act. within the, it was really the basis for expulsion for an ordained person, an ordained person. And so to be cruel or mean-spirited towards anyone who's practicing the Dharma, from within a Buddhist perspective, carries with it really bad karma, right? Don't do that. And so here, never disparaging Bodhisattva, in a sense, is both perhaps practicing. So why was he doing this? It doesn't say, but from a Buddhist perspective, it could be sort of credibly understood that he was engaging in that practice and being on the receiving end of all of that scorn because of things he had done in his past life that he needed to work out. And so think of Milarepa, right? The great Indian yogi who did very terrible things in his life. And when he went to his study with his teacher put him through these incredibly arduous tasks and wouldn't give him the teachings. It went on for years, up to the point where Milarepa was basically ready to quit, to leave. And his wife interceded, his teacher's wife interceded, and finally, and the sense of all of that is that he had this such profoundly terrible binding karma that he had to work through that. In many schools of Buddhism, there's the practice of doing hundreds, thousands of bows, which are a way of prostrations to the Buddha, as a way of sort of working off one's negative karma. Sometimes they're spoken of as bows of repentance. Okay, so any thoughts about that? Mm-hmm.
I've always been very interested in those practices where there's like so many repetitions, you know, so many prostrations, and it's looked at as kind of purifying your karma. And I remember speaking with a practitioner who practices in Vajrayana and had done Nundro and those practices, and she said, "Well, you know, you're doing that too in your zazen. It just like looks different." And I reflected on that, you know, and my early years of practice and like really like sitting through such storms of my mind, you know, and it's just like a different form of that same sort of forbearance and purification in that way of having to weather our own karma, you know.
Right. And to, patience, forbear, to endure that, particularly because so there are so many times where you may be practicing as best you can and they persist, right? They do not seem to yield. And that not only in that period of Zazen, but over time.
Yes.
Right. And so we go through periods that can be very, very challenging, right? Deserts. Right, where everything becomes very dry, or everything becomes very tumultuous.
Yeah.
And so to think of that, and you know, very much sort of within the Chan or the Zen tradition, which is to turn all of that into the nakedness, right, of mind, and so that there is no activity, right, to sort of. And that, you know, it's a very challenging practice because it really, at its best, it's really challenging us to actually work through that. It has to be released through the whole body and mind. And what can happen with all of that is we just get tighter and tighter, right? As we try and, you know, build our fortress, or we endure it by just gritting our teeth rather than, I mean, really the revolution is to embody the unity between samsara and nirvana, between delusion and enlightenment in that moment, even when that seems a million miles away, by not fighting it. By rather than fighting or pushing against it, by relaxing the whole body and say, please come in, right? There, I have a space for you here. So there is sadness, so let us be sad together. There is anger, so let us be angry together, right? I can do that. I will do that. And to do that in a way that actually, you know, to think of it as a purification, that actually is a washing through. Yeah. So that's why working with, you know, the posture, you know, the relaxation within the posture is so important, because there's such a strong inclination, right, with things that are difficult, to keep them outside the gate, you know, to protect ourselves against them. And so it can feel very counterintuitive, particularly in the beginning, to actually let it in. I was just thinking that I was at the ear doctor this afternoon, because I have to get new hearing aids so I can hear your lovely voices and not be trying to cob together what you said. And I have a lot of earwax, so he had to go in, and it was pretty painful. And I was like, okay, this is it. This is it. Like non-duality, right? Right, don't, because he kept saying, don't move. If you move, I'm going to puncture your eardrum.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So it was like... I had been warned by my audiologist that this doctor has a fairly direct approach. He said there's another doctor across the river that has a much gentler approach, and I thought, oh, that's a further drive.
But some,
but I still need hearing aids. Anyway, but I'm glad you brought that up, because to, you know, it's like looking at these different traditions, different practices, whatever needs to happen wherever we are. In other words, whatever path we are in, if it's Buddha Dharma, the things that need to happen on the path of liberation have to happen in that path, right? Because I'm me, right? So whether I'm in this stream or I'm in this stream, if it's Buddha Dharma, it has to be addressing whatever is needing to be addressed in order to free ourselves. And so that's where there are some practices that might be sort more obvious in terms of how that's happening. So look then, you know, in a more subtle way to see how it might be happening already for you. Okay, anybody else? You go.
Are we saying come on in to what's coming up, or just acknowledging that it's all there and being with it all?
Same.
It's the same.
Yeah. I mean, in the beginning, think about, you know, when instruction is, you know, you sit, you're focusing your breath, and then you acknowledge. Mm-hmm. And what does that mean, acknowledge, right? It means to know, to see, to recognize. So which means the mind has to be alert and aware. It's not distant, it's not vague. So that we're studying the mind in that moment, we're seeing the self arise in that form, in that expression. So we're gaining a little bit of understanding about that self arising in that moment, because we're going to see it again, and we're going to see it again, and we're going to see it again. And we're going to see some things a million times. And some of those things are going to be light, and it's just like, you know, habitual sort of thinking, and we practice that in a light way, but persistently. And some things are going to be very heavy. And so we're going to have to practice them in a heavier way, or with a heavier sort of, you know, effective practice, and over again. But first we have to really acknowledge it very intimately. And so in that sense, we are inviting it in, so that we're not denying it or ignoring it, right, or suppressing it. In the beginning, to say to somebody who's just beginning to sit, invite it in, will probably just be a wrestling match. You know, we'll just be getting entangled. And so to keep things very simple and say, just see it, right? Because there's very little basis yet for actually being able to meet something in a more, in a deeper way, in a clearer way without getting entangled, because we haven't really developed any mindfulness yet. And so I think to just work with that language of acknowledge, just see it, right? And so, but in essence, yes, it's the same thing. You're inviting it in a sense, to the degree that we're ready. So it's like, you know, some really annoying, you know, hard to be with person shows up at your door, right? And they want to come in. And you're just beginning to practice. And so you open the door, maybe you just look through the keyhole, and they say, yeah, I see who it is. Glad to see you. Can't come in right now, but I see you. Right? Not quite ready.
This is a question from Mikhail. Why do the four kinds of believers disparage him? Why do they get angry? Do they lack faith in themselves?
That would be an explanation. There are many things we could say about that. In the sutra, it says that this is the age of the counterfeit dharma. So remember, this is that teaching of the sort of degeneration, the dissolution of the dharma, where it's becoming harder and harder to practice well and to encounter the dharma in a way that is true. And the practitioners, in the wording of the, in the phrasing of the Buddha, are becoming overbearingly arrogant. And you know, this is not hypothetical. This happens. It happens in every country where Buddhism has been. It happens here. It is happening here. It will continue to happen here. It's what people do. It's what institutions do. It's what happens over time. I mean, just think of the laws of entropy, right? That the law is that things tend to move towards, you know, sort of outward. And so that as practitioners, as communities, it is really the imperative is that we ask of ourselves that we practice as diligently as we can for ourselves, for our Sangha, and for the future, right? In other words, we sort of practice and try to arrest that tendency that is to move towards what is more and more comfortable, what is getting caught up in things. And so, I mean, there's so many teachings in the present, you know, but our very traditional teachings that talk about monastics specifically, who are performing all kinds of traditional monastic functions just for money. You know, their heart's not in it. There's not a teaching in it. They're just doing it for wealth. They're doing it to gain notoriety. These teachers are clearly giving a message, you know, about what they're seeing going on. And so I think that prediction, if the Buddha actually made that prediction hundreds of years ago, I don't think, my way of understanding it is not that it was something unique, you know, something happened in the Dharma at that time that meant it was going to degenerate. That's just what happens. Everything's impermanent and things move towards, you know, if you don't clean your house, right, and you don't maintain it, it will literally fall apart, right? Literally. And so you have to keep putting energy into it, right? Keep putting energy into it in order for it to stay healthy and intact. And so I think that's what that's describing. Okay, why don't we take a little break for about 5 minutes, and then we'll come back and work with this last chapter on Avalokiteshvara. So if we think about the, think about some of the main themes that the sutra has really made prominent and kind of explicit. Expedient means is one of the sort of recurring themes that runs throughout the whole sutra and made very explicit, right? And that's, I don't know if that happens in any other Mahayana sutra in that way. I mean, you could say that everything is that, but it's so explicit in terms of being named and called out. And then all the parables, virtually every parable was an example of skillful means. And then this chapter on the Bodhisattva perceiver of the world's sounds, Avalokiteshvara. And I want to just bring out two main aspects of this chapter, which are, one is that all of these, so the Buddha says, suppose there are immeasurable hundreds, thousands, ten thousands, millions of living beings who are undergoing various trials and suffering. If they hear of this Bodhisattva, perceiver of the world's sounds, and single-mindedly call their name, then at once they will perceive the sound of their voices, that is Avalokiteshvara will, and they will all gain deliverance from their trials. And then the sutra goes on to describe all of these various situations, somebody in a great fire, somebody who's in a ship that's been blown off course, somebody who faces imminent attack, and so on. All of these very difficult situations, that in all of them, if they call the name of Avalokiteshvara, then all their bonds will be severed and broken, and they will gain deliverance. You must call single-mindedly on the name of Avalokiteshvara. The Bodhisattva can grant fearlessness. That mudra is the mudra of fearlessness. So Mahapajapati is, that's one of aspect of the mudra that she's presenting. If you call, you'll be delivered from evil-hearted bandits. And so on and on it goes. For this reason, living beings should constantly keep the thought of Avalokiteshvara in mind. Right? So that's one aspect. And it's very explicit, right? It's very, like, if you're in trouble, you do this, you call single-mindedly to mind the name of Avalokiteshvara, and you will be freed of that adversity, that challenge. And then the Buddha's asked, how does this Bodhisattva come and go in this Saha world? You know, I was thinking about, every month I meet with a few teachers that a small sort of cohort, and we talk about, you know, shop. And we were talking about some current thing that was going on in the world. I don't remember what it was. And, you know, just sort of feeling the burden, the weight of that, the pain of that. And one of the teachers said, you know, this is the Saha world. And another teacher said, right, thanks for reminding me. In other words, this is the world that Buddhism is constantly pointing at, right? That when we do not understand the nature of mind, the nature of ourselves, when we are, you know, sort of in the mercy of, governed by false views and our attachments and our kleshas, this is the world, right, that will come forth. And, of course, in each time, each generation has their particular world. And so we have our world feels very particular to us, right, in the same way that when we are struggling under our own weight of our mind and emotions and memories and histories and so on, it feels very particular. It doesn't feel universal. It feels very specific, and it's painful, and it's right there. And so I think what I understood and what that teacher was saying when she said thank you is just like, right, right? This is the cycle that keeps happening. This is the cycle that we vow to do all that we can to heal it, and we should not be surprised. You know, I was thinking about this actually. I'm just going to say this and then run right past it because I don't want to go down this rabbit hole. But I was thinking about these elections that just happened. And some of these GOP candidates who, you know, were at the insurrection, were some of them are charged with crimes. One of them is actually in jail. And they're being elected. They're being nominated, right, to run for their party for very significant positions. And I thought about Trump and how the karma of what he created, didn't start, but created, is going beyond him, right? It's going beyond. And it's like, that's what happens, right? It just keeps going and it gets, and it accumulates and it gets bigger and it can't actually be controlled, right? People who think, well, I might be just saying this shit, I don't believe it, but I'm saying this because this is what I have to do to get elected, but I'm in control of it, right? Maybe once I'm in office, then I'll, but that's unlikely to happen because it just keeps going and it becomes a force that's larger when it's, and that's the nature of samsara, is it gets out of control, right? We think we can manage it, we think we can control it, because it's based in forces that we are not governing, that we do not understand, that we are not really even aware of, it's already out of control, right? And when we accentuate that, right, when we increase that, then it's going to go in that direction. So, until it gets interrupted, right? Until something presents itself to interrupt. So that's what we're working on.
What do you think that could be? What do you think that could be?
The interruption? And I think it has to be 100,000 things. It's like, how do we free ourselves? Is there one thing you can do to free yourself? No, we have to do a universe of practices and have a whole lifetime of moments and awarenesses and actions, right? It has to be a whole integrated thing, which is great because then anywhere somebody is leaning into that, anywhere somebody is turning towards that and creating some disruption or some interruption in that cycle is doing that, right? Because to wait for some solution, right, is not going to happen, not that way. So how does Avalokiteshvara function in this world? How do they preach the Dharma? How do they, for the sake of living beings, how does the power of their expedient means apply in their case? And so then the Buddha goes through this long list of in whatever land, in whatever time, when someone needs compassion, when someone needs help, and they need it to show up in this way, that's how Avalokiteshvara shows up. And so the sutra takes us through all of these different forms of beings, people in different positions, of different ages, of different statuses, of different skills, that whatever they need, that's how, and that when that being arrives, appears in that form, which is particularly suited to the needs of that person, that's Avalokiteshvara. The Buddha says, Avalokiteshvara has succeeded in acquiring benefits such as these, that is, the ability to appear in all these different forms and taking on a variety of different forms and going about among the land saving living beings. For this reason, you and others should single-mindedly offer alms to Avalokiteshvara. She can bestow fearlessness on those who are fearful, pressing or difficult circumstances. This is why in this Saha world, everyone calls Avalokiteshvara the bestower of fearlessness. And what a wonderful thing to offer, right? The bestower of fearlessness. And then there's this very interesting kind of coda to that passage where the bodhisattva who's been asking these questions and being in dialogue says, I must now offer alms to bodhisattva, perceiver of the world's sounds. And so they took off a necklace adorned with numerous precious gems worth 100,000s of dollars and says, please accept this necklace of precious gems as a gift of the Dharma. And at that time, the bodhisattva perceiver of the world sounds was unwilling to accept the gift. And so the bodhisattva speaks once more and says, please, out of compassion for all of us, please accept this necklace. And then the Buddha steps in and says, out of compassion for this bodhisattva, inexhaustible intent, and for the four kinds of believers, the heavenly beings, the dragons, everybody in this assembly, you should accept the necklace. And thereupon, Avalokiteshvara, having compassion, accepts the necklace and with their supernatural powers divides it into two and presents one part to Shakyamuni and the other to the Buddha who is in the tower from the previous chapters. Okay, so the question I wanted to ask is, how do you, in reading this section where first Avalokiteshvara takes on all these different forms, so how do you understand that? How are you hearing that? And then how do you understand all of these different situations that are presented? And that if you just call to mind the name of Avalokiteshvara, then you will be freed, saved, delivered from that difficulty. So how are you hearing that? Imagining that you paused and reflected on that carefully. Jacob?
I was wondering about that just because, like, I feel like we often say that Buddhism is a non-theistic tradition, and mm-hmm. this feels very much like a god that mm-hmm. you would call upon, mm-hmm. and that kind of saves you. And I guess also, like, one way that I was thinking of it was like in a difficult moment, just to remember the aspect of compassion, like the possibility of acting with compassion or someone else acting with compassion, just to sort of introduce that mm-hmm. back into a circumstance in which it might have mm-hmm. feel inaccessible or forgotten or not, mm-hmm. Like it could never happen.
Okay. Anybody else? Laurel, and then Sege.
It feels like it's calling upon, it's an act of faith to, I guess it's making me think about my Quaker roots, and Quakers have this belief in inner light, and sort of like there's that of God or whatever in every person. And so when I'm like taking this in, it makes me think of that, like you have your inner, mm-hmm. your inner savior mm-hmm. that you're calling on. Like mm-hmm. if you can pause and access that. Mm-hmm. So like, it's an internalized capacity that we all have mm-hmm. that we can call upon or not.
Mm-hmm. And to think about, you know, just such a moment, and right, we've all been in, I mean, it doesn't have to be such a stark and dramatic moment, but to such a moment where we're facing something, right, that we feel what? Inadequate, afraid, overwhelmed, and that something is in front of us, something is pressing in, we're in a circumstance that we're not really in control of, and may not be in control of, that where the consequences seem real and not good, right? And to think about that state of mind, right? How easy it is. What is the easiest state of mind to assume at that moment, right? If you don't try, right? If you just sort of go with whatever the reaction is, right? Sort of more, you know, habitual response. And then what happens, sort of step into that, and then what happens in that moment of calling, right? Calling forward. What's required to actually even do that? What do you need to have present within you to actually even be able to do that? And then what are you doing when you call? So the sutra keeps saying, call the name of Avalokiteshvara. And remember that, you know, historically, names are very powerful. Right? That there is in the name is what? Can you say from your studies? Yeah. I'm just wondering if you've, in your studies, if you've come across, like, historically in different cultures, what? I know I'm putting you on the spot here.
I mean, I don't know about in Buddhist cultures, no, for example, but like if we think about even like the Bible, right, like the names of things kind of like are the thing. And certainly the name of God has this kind of like great kind of esoteric power associated with it, similar to the way we might think of a Dharani, where like even the sounds or the shapes of the letters kind of are the thing, not just that they refer to it, right, but that the name has a kind of materiality, like it is something in and of itself, not just like pointing.
Right. Excellent. Thank you. So, a second. Yeah.
I was thinking about the act of calling as being a kind of merging into the identity of, mm-hmm, and becoming, relinquishing the self in a way, so that the true nature of transience is felt, of this thing that feels so solid and real, mm-hmm, that's happening. Mm-hmm. It is happening, but, mm-hmm, it is also continually moving, mm-hmm, and that calling and merging kind of helps shift into that fluidity.
Yeah. I think it's a very interesting chapter, really, because, and you can see how, or I think of how this chapter and other aspects of this sutra could appeal to so many different people on different levels. You know, so it could very much appeal to somebody who really is seeking something, some power, some deity, some bodhisattva that is, you know, that exists, that they can call upon, that has these qualities, that is always present, that has this great compassion, and that they can call upon. And so that based in faith, a kind of deity, a kind of worship, a kind of prayer for deliverance to, you know, in a moment where we feel too small, you know, too unpowerful to do this ourselves. And so we want to, that urge to call upon something greater, right? And so all the ways, for all the ways in which that can help someone, right? Even if it might be an outside power, an other power in their experience, you know, in their mind, they're calling upon something that for them, they may be perceiving as outside, but it's helping them, right? It's really helping them. And then to bring it in, you know, more in terms of how we would understand it, that even in that, you know, in invoking a bodhisattva or Avalokiteshvara, to bring to mind, to ask, to invoke, to ask for support, to ask for guidance, to ask to be given or be offered those qualities, right? That can be externalized, right? It can also be internalized, right? In other words, we can use that form as a way to direct our attention to something that we know is right here, right? But gives it a sort of tangible quality that can make the actual practice more powerful, more real to us, right? Because we're actually visualizing or invoking such a being and bringing into that being, that visualized being, those qualities. And so it becomes real in our mind in the same way that when I look at a tree and my mind creates an image of that tree, that's real in my mind, right? And so from a Buddhist perspective, one we can infer has an outside existence. One has a wholly internal existence. But my knowing of that is the same, right? Because in both cases, I'm relying upon the image that my mind is creating of that object. And the reality that I experience, right, to call to mind that being. Hakuin says, and he's not specifically, I changed the wording to apply, he was talking about, I think he was just talking about the Buddha. But he says, whether you sit in meditation, recite the sutras, or call the name of Kanon Bodhisattva. So regardless of what the practice is that you're doing, if you devote all of your efforts to what you're doing, I just want to get that word in again, the unproduced Dharma patience that is deep within contemplation, remaining unmoving where there's no mental discrimination. So whatever the practice is, if you're doing it within that mind, you devote all of your efforts to what you're doing and attain to the ultimate, you will kick down the dark cave of delusion, scatter the thieves of the five desires, illuminate the great mirror, and realize the great matter. And so again, remember to think of Avalokiteshvara as the bestower of fearlessness. So in that moment when we're afraid, which is a very a fragile moment, right? We feel fragile. Right. And so to bring that to mind, right, to have mind enough, awareness enough to actually bring able to bring to mind practice, your meditation, to know what you're feeling, to be able to actually sit in that ground right there, to sit in that dentist chair, right, while the drilling is happening. Right? And it hurts, or you're afraid that it's going to hurt, right? And to gather yourself and bring yourself to that moment, right? Because you have trained yourself to do that. You know how to do that. That now you are in your seat. You have reclaimed your seat. You have reclaimed your power, right? Something is happening, right, that may not be in your control. But what is in your control is your experience of it, right? How you are going to experience this, right? And so the Buddha says, if we bring to mind with constant reverence this, think with constant reverence of Bodhisattva, perceiver of the world sounds, and we can shed our desires. We can let fall away all of those agitations that scatter us. And he says, for this reason, beings should constantly keep the thought of Avalokiteshvara in mind. And so to think about what are those things that we're invoking when we invoke Kanon Bodhisattva or Buddha or Manjushri. That's why these different beings, bodhisattvas, are sort of are endowed with certain qualities, so that if we're practicing with that bodhisattva, we're practicing with those qualities. And so compassion, patience, impartiality, fearlessness, loving kindness.
So, a couple comments, quite a few actually. Mm-hmm. Kemu first, by saying a name, you can have your problems fixed. Is it more about saying the name, i.e. being manifesting compassion and fearlessness in yourself, no duality, no matter what is happening to you? So you may go down with the ship, so to speak, but you'll be okay about it because you are in a fearless state and non-dual manifesting bodhisattva Buddha mind?
Well, I mean, I can't promise how it's going to work out. But, you know, in other words, the sutra, as sutras often do, present sort of an ultimate experience, right? From an ultimate perspective, as Hakuin does. You know, that you'll scatter the five seas, illuminate the great mirror, realize the great matter, really presenting it from a sort of an ultimate perspective. As practitioners, in a very trying or challenging moment, we may experience somewhere along the spectrum of that, right? And it may not be an absolute, right? We may be afraid, right, fearful, and be practicing to the best of our ability. So let's not expect anything in particular. But what's the alternative? How else might we go about it, right? And so to rely upon our training our training is to help us live in every moment and also to die. It's really helping us to be able to die, right? So that when that moment comes, you know, I remember the Dalai Lama saying that and talking about how, so that when we die, you know, we can be present, we can be mindful, we can have understanding about what we're experiencing. We can actually go through it, you know, not being pulled along something that is, we don't want, but we're actually practicing it. And then he said something like, you know, but I don't know. If I'm like in a plane and it's going down, I don't know how that's going to be. You know, and I was like, let's be realistic about this, right? And so, I don't know. I don't know how I would handle such a moment, right? That's why I think about a moment, such a simple moment like being in a doctor's chair, right? That's pretty small potatoes, right? And yet seeing, and Shanti Deva says that, he says, you know, we like, you know, we, ow, when we get bit by a mosquito or pricked by a thorn, right? That's how sensitive we are. That's how we feel pain, right? And so I think, you know, I, in such moments as that, you know, I try and really practice them, but also be thinking, this is nothing. This is nothing, and it's still challenging, right? I actually have to practice it because my tendency is to, you know, and it makes me think about some different kind of moment, you know, that's going to be much more serious. How will I be able to bring myself forward? I don't know. But that's why let's take advantage of those smaller moments, you know, to train ourselves. It helps in that moment, right? And it's also giving us some experience.
And from Joe, can we raise fearlessness as a facet of Bodhi mind, such as speaking up for the oppressed or doing a right action when it is unpopular in the public opinion, or even setting aside our own strongly held desires without a second thought?
Yeah, or with a second thought. And then responding, you know, yes. I mean, fearlessness, you know, let's not think of fearlessness as those moments where there is no fear, but fearlessness in fear, practicing fearlessness when we are afraid, right? And so it doesn't mean that there's an absence of fear, but that we are practicing the fear, and that we call that fearlessness, one experience of fearlessness.
Chris asked, does invoking a name like this invoke a visual image, like a skillful tool that reminds us of our training, mm-hmm. or liturgy, like a recentering?
It can, you know, so, I mean, Camus also asked this question. It's like, is it just calling the name to mind? Well, you know that you can say a name in your mind. You can say Avalokiteshvara, and it has no impact at all, right? If your mind, if you're saying it in a very sort of, you know, not with all of your efforts, not devoting all of your efforts. We all know that experience. And hopefully we've all had the experience when we bring it to mind in a different way, in a way that is within, as he says, when you sit in meditation, when you're reciting the sutras, calling the name, if you devote all of your efforts, you do it wholeheartedly, right? Without reserve, relying on your meditation, your mindfulness, right? You're developing samadhi. That's different. That's a different calling to mind. The name. And the name itself is different, which is really what I understand, that it may be understood in certain ways that even the letters, you know. But from a Buddhist perspective, the power is not ever separate from mind, right? That the power does not exist within a letter or within a sound. It is in the mind. And that's why we practice, is to cultivate, bring forth that spiritual power that we all have for all the ordinary moments and all the other than ordinary moments. And so it's, if you just call the name to mind, like just awareness in Shikantaza, just this, yes, that's what we're practicing for, right? That kind of just.
There's a couple more comments. Mark was talking about, I think naming Avalokiteshvara as perhaps invoking a realization of a rise in compassion in self and other. I think of my sister in a hospital and the beings who enter into her field to help her. Mm-hmm. And then Sharon shared, mm-hmm. an injured fawn yesterday, twisted legs as if hit by a car. I felt great despair at first, then called upon Avalokiteshvara. And in time, the fawn somehow managed to get up and seemed to use his legs to move away from the road. I wonder about that and leave it to the mystery.
Yeah. And you walk away wondering. And, you know, we don't always know, right? But the one thing that we know is that in that moment, there's a way we can respond, right? That is not just feeling empathy or feeling pain, feeling suffering, feeling, you know, impotent, but we can actually offer something that you can't measure, right? And that whatever the response is that because of something we offered? I don't know. But there is much in this world that is worth wondering, worth wonder, right? And this, you know, this is about faith, you know, and for some, I mean, if, you know, if I had heard my teacher talk about Avalokiteshvara in this way in the beginning, I probably wouldn't have even heard him. So, it would have gone right through. Because it would have sounded a lot like God, you know, and that I didn't have faith in that. I wasn't seeking that, right? And I, because that was kind of the only way I could understand it, right? I didn't have experience within myself, or I hadn't recognized experiences I'd had in which would allow me to relate to that in a different way, to understand that in a different way. So, yeah. But even, you know, like with somebody, even, you know, imagery is very powerful. And you think about people who are not Buddhists and have a Buddha image, you know, in their garden. Or, you know, my mother went through a whole sculpting Kanon Bodhisattva period. You know, she didn't consider herself a Buddhist. But there was something about that image which was very compelling to her, right? She wanted to be creating that with her hands. She wanted to have it in her house, something she could see, right? We're like that. Okay, so maybe we'll conclude our time here. And I hope it's been helpful. And it's nice to work on sutras together. And so thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
And can we finish with the four vows?
To put an end to them.
if I could just say my own coda, I'm going to go into a little solo for the weekend. I'm going to come back for the art practice. But I just wanted to say a little bit about that, because it's kind of in spirit of what I was saying before about the inclination to, for a person, community, a practice, to become more diffuse, and that putting energy in. And so, I have always thought that the most important thing for any student and any teacher is to be a student, is to be a student of the Dharma. Then in a sense, that is always foremost. And I very much feel that way myself, that that is my sort of how I experience myself in the world, is as a student of this Dharma. And it delights me that as I get older and continue practicing, that my hunger for that not only not diminishes, but actually it gets stronger, which I am very happy that that is true. And so these solos, these short solos, are ways for me to feed that hunger. And that part of the reason I want to do it every month is because in the beginning it was hard to do that, to step out. You know, it's like Bai Zhang said, if, you know, work of no, a day of no work is a day of no food. And so I felt like I'm not offering something. And so it was hard for me to do that, to actually take that time. And so I thought I need to just keep doing it, because then it'll get easier. And I won't feel guilty doing it, because I don't think I should, but I do, because that's my thing. And so, the ways in which it keeps my practice of a student of the Dharma very alive, and not just in words, but in a very real way, that I feel that evolving. And that, you know, that's what I want to bring to you, right, is that you know that that never ends, that that never ends, and that that is the most glorious thing, right, because it just gets better. But I need to know that, right? I need to keep knowing that. And for not just to be something that I know, but something that I'm experiencing. And so, so goodbye. Although it will be, I don't want to miss the art practice, so I'll be there tomorrow for that. Okay. Okay, good night, everybody.